You're all feeling it's been worth your time and money, because the way the world is today, everything is calculated in money, right? Time, money. You have to spend money to come here, which you could otherwise have spent in other ways. And you could have also utilized the time to make more money, because as the saying goes, time is money. So you have taken out time to come here. And I hope you all feel that your time and money is well invested, if we see everything in terms of money, as we are in the money culture, which is stated in Bhagavatam. Vitam o vitam eva kalon rinam janma chara guna daya. In Kali Yuga, if someone has money, he's considered to be very aristocratic, high class, and cultured. Whatever he does, he's a gentleman if you have money. As Srila Prabhupada quite often pointed out, if someone has money and they wear a suit, they're considered very respectable. Never mind how they get the money, but that. And if you don't have money, you're considered just completely useless. In fact, in the American Protestant ethic, if you don't have money, that means you don't have the grace of God. Means you're not, there's something wrong, there's something intrinsically wrong with you. It's wrong to not have money. Whereas in Vedic culture, the topmost respected people are those who are voluntarily poor, brahmanas. They won't take money. Of course, they may accept charity, but they deliberately live, the best brahmanas live a poor life. There are gradations of brahmanas given in the Bhagavatam, and there are some who pick up grains from the threshing after the grains have been threshed. I don't know if you even know what that means, because you just buy flour. You don't even buy flour, you just buy bread, right? But there is a process of threshing to separate the grains from the husk. And then you have to take out all the stones. Shurpa Naka, this is the name of the wife, sister of Ravana. So Shurpa means this threshing basket. So what was I talking about? The money culture. Yeah, Brahmins, also, the best ones are those who they'll never beg. Ajagaravriti, this Madhavendra Puri, he would never even ask. As a sannyasi, he can ask from seven houses in a day, and whatever he gets. And if he gets enough in two, three houses, but he won't even take more than he needs. But the others, he won't even ask. If someone gives him something, he'll take it. Otherwise, he won't. He'll just fast. So the more renounced you are, the better you're supposed to be. Whereas it's just the opposite of the money culture, where the more greedy and exploitive you are, and you're better. Which is why I often say that compared to modern leaders, Hitler was better, because at least he said, look, we're Germans, and to hell with all of you. We'll kill you all and we'll just trample all over you. Whereas in the modern age they say peace, justice, democracy, humanitarianism, and then they bomb you and kill you and subvert your government and all this kind of thing. So at least Hitler was more honest about it. But it's the same thing that goes on somehow. Beg, steal, or borrow. We just sang it. Kinibo lutibo, harinama rasa. Bhaktivinoda Thakur said that propensity for getting something by any means, that should be for Harinama Rasa, not for money. So anyway, devotees are locked into this money culture. So we measure everything we tend to measure everything in terms of money. That's just the consciousness that everyone has. Modern Indian culture, in India itself, it's very much dominated by the idea from the beginning of life that the children have to be trained. They have to, from early life, they have to go to tuitions. You'll see, sometimes maybe because in India the roofs of houses, now it's all becoming more and more high rise, but the regular houses have a flat roof, and often we go and chant after Mangalati on the roof. There's often a pleasant breeze, cool breeze before the heat of the day. And on the opposite roof, you'll find there's a tuitions class going on. Kids, 8 years old, before, this is just at daybreaks, 5:30 in the morning, they'll be studying before they go to school. And then in the evening also, there are other batches. So from the beginning of life, the kids are just school and then tuitions and study, so they can get ahead and then work hard to get their degree, and then they get a job in which they're working long hours, and somehow they have to, the whole idea is that they are seen to be a success, which means they get a high position and they earn plenty of money. And their whole human life, which is meant for God realization, is just lost in the pressure to earn money more than they need. So our aim of life is different. Our aim of life is, human life is meant for God realization, and everything else is subordinate to that. Krishna consciousness is not an appendage to being a success in this material world, which is completely nonsense anyway. The idea of being successful in this material world is completely meaningless, to be successful. It's just like, again in India, you don't see in America. Actually, I heard a dog barking last night in the middle of the night. I thought, what's going on? I'm back in India. That's a normal thing in India, in the streets. The dogs are barking at night all while. So in a group of dogs, one barks louder than the others and becomes respected as the top dog. He's a success. It's like that. You become big man, respected by others. It's all meaningless. Completely meaningless. So, our life is meant for God realization. So, you are practically demonstrating that in coming here, I hope. I mean, it could be. People can come for ulterior motives also. Or maybe they seek. Sometimes it's promoted like that. Krishna consciousness. Religion is something to help us psychologically to go on with in our stressful lives. That was actually in Back to Godhead in about 1976. There was an alternative approach put in the Back to Godhead magazine. They had little pictures at the front of Back to Godhead showing normal people saying things like, Robert Grant, printing executive, I'm under, then a little quote from him, I'm under a lot of, with Kami clothes. Actually, it's Rameshwar who is the head of the BBT, but he's posing as a Karmi. You know what the word Karmi means? It means non-devotee, basically. So he says, printing executive, I'm under a lot of pressure to perform, but when I chant the Hare Krishna mantra, it helps me get through the day, and all things like that. So and so. Artist, and it'd be Jadurani or something like Judy, whatever her name is. Judy, I can't remember. That when I chant the Hare Krishna mantra, it gives me so much creative inspiration. And like this, they're trying to present that chanting Hare Krishna helps you to be a better materialist, or it gives you relief from all the pressure and all this. And some devotees weren't very happy with this. They showed it to Prabhupada. Prabhupada's response was to change the whole editorial staff. And then the new Back to Godhead came out, and two of the articles in it. One was called "The Demons Among Us," and the article started with, "What is a demon?" Generally, we think about someone with six heads and four arms and big fangs, but according to Bhagavad Gita, it could be your next door neighbor or your bank manager, or the postman, or you. And there was another article, whatever it was, $3.2 billion moon hoax. In those days, whatever they said, go to the moon, it was actually peanuts nowadays, because they use that just for killing a few people in Yemen or whatever with a drone. But it was a lot of money in those days. So it was really punchy. Prabhupada, he liked that. He stopped. He didn't want this. Well, chant Hare Krishna and you can get relief from stress. Srila Prabhupada said we should promote chanting Hare Krishna to get love of God. So anyway, you've all come here, and I'm just thank you for coming. Thank you for coming means there's no festival without people. You can have all organization, but unless people come, there's no festival. So thank you for that. Thank you for the organizers, all the effort they've put in. Some have put considerable monetary contribution. So I hope you're finding it. It's not over yet. I hope you're finding it worth your valuable time. All of your time is valuable. Means this human life is valuable. Every moment is valuable, should be utilized in the service of Krishna. So I hope you're finding that it's very helpful. And I hope that by Krishna's grace we can continue to do this in America each year, at least once a year, probably not more than once a year. So Hare Krishna, thanks to all. And let's get on with the questions. This is a question from Sujata. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. You mentioned Srila Prabhupada's relaxed or did not introduce all the regulations in the beginning when devotees were just joining the movement. Does this apply now? Where can we draw a line as in the allowance to make new devotees? Will this lead to an eventual compromise in standards? Very thoughtful question. Thank you for that. I did address this issue to some extent in my latest book. I think it's the latest one. I'm not sure if Putra Upadesh came out after that. But anyway, recent book, Women Masters or Mothers, in which I discussed that Prabhupada was very liberal in the early days, but then later on he increased the rules and regulations. But I discussed in there that on the one hand, we want to show an alternative society with a different purpose of life, disciplined life, a life of commitment. On the other hand, we have to recognize that people are where they are at now. It was in this book and also in the Speaking Strongly book, I discussed this, on Speaking Strongly in Srila Prabhupada's service. In regards to the topic of bridge preaching, which we hear a lot about nowadays, all preaching is bridge preaching because we're in one position and we're trying to bring people from a different position to the position we're in, and there is a divide. So all preaching means that we have to make contact and communication with people on the other side of the divide, which means going to them, and not just physically, but mentally, emotionally, making contact, making communication, and bringing them to this side of the... So all preaching is bridge preaching. And on principle, we can do anything, for anything can be done for the sake of preaching. When Harikesh Swami at the time was sent to Russia by Srila Prabhupada, he himself recounted, it was in Vrindavan in about 1979, Prabhupada's disappearance day. He gave a very emotional talk in which he said how Prabhupada was kicking him out again and again. Don't stay with me and type, go to Russia. And he was giving excuses. Why, I can't go there. And the last thing he said, well, there's only meat to eat. And Prabhupada said, then eat meat, but go and preach. So theoretically, one can do anything for the sake of preaching. But on the other hand, Haridas Thakur's disappearance day to day, so achar, or proper behavior, and prachar, they go together, because we may preach, but we are preaching to people to come to a different mode of life. So we also have to demonstrate that, because if we don't demonstrate that, then what is, or if we don't follow it ourselves, then what is the meaning? As Srila Prabhupada noted in that Bhagavad Gita purport, that so you can't preach to someone not to smoke cigarettes if you yourself smoke cigarettes. It's not going to have the effect. So both things are needed, but we have to see that people are a long way from Krishna consciousness. We have to make communication with them and bring them to Krishna consciousness, and we can't expect people to just switch overnight. So there's always going to be, as long as we're in the material world, and especially as long as we're in a culture which doesn't recognize Vedic authority, then there's always going to be a need to gradually train people in Vedic culture. In that sense, people who were preaching in India previously, they had a great advantage, because most people they were preaching among, they believed in the authority of the Vedas. And so if you can convince someone that their philosophy, that the philosophy that you're expounding is correct, then they would be prepared to follow it. But now there was a great blow to Vedic culture when Buddha rejected the Vedas, and Mahavira Jainism rejected the Vedas. But in this country, or in the Western world in general, people don't have faith in that, and they have faith in just the opposite. They're not following any authority. Although, of course, everyone has to follow some authority. So, a lot of acculturation is required, but as I noted in these books, by this time in our movement, we should have been able to show some good level of culture. Not that our devotees still are behaviorally and maybe psychologically or emotionally lechers. Chanting Hare Krishna and having at least a theoretical knowledge of the philosophy of Krishna consciousness, but the mindset very much shaped by Western culture. So now there is some requirement, I believe, that the devotees have to have some Bhakti Shastri course before they can be brahminically initiated. That's something, but there's also behavior, attitude, mode of life. If one is earning a salary, then how can he be a Brahmin? Vaishnava is more than a Brahmin, but if we're going to establish Varnashram, then we can't have people earning salaries being Brahmins. Their mode of life has to be Brahma, absorbed in the spiritual. Or Brahma also means the Vedas, so they have to be absorbed. Even if they're a materialistic Brahmin, is also Karma Kandya Brahmins, but they're absorbed in the Vedic, following Vedic injunctions at every, and chanting mantras and all these things. So, standards, implementing standards. There'll always be a need to reach out and bring people in gradually, but we should also have a model of what we're bringing them to and show a better way of life. Now there's controversy about Krishna West, and the idea that we should all wear Western clothing and preach and this and that. So that is not total. That's not totally wrong by any means. That may be required or helpful for some people, but actually, there's a symbolism in dress. Whether it's Western dress, there's a symbolism in that also, that we are part of wearing conventional Western dress, whatever that is. But okay, let's say casual dress is some kind of t-shirt and casual jeans or whatever. But that symbolizes that, okay, I'm normal and what's considered normal. There's a symbolism in that, and there's a symbolism in this dress also, saying that, well, we have different values and different lifestyle to that. There's a symbolism there. So there is a case for that, but there's also a case for wearing dress like this to announce to others that we are different. And if you want to be different, you can be different like this. If you want to chant Hare Krishna in wearing jeans and a t-shirt, well, I guess you could join Krishna West. But I don't know where the playing piano comes into that. Anyway, the point is that there were standards should be there. We should be demonstrating a different way of life, which is based on rejection of the values of the present insanely materialistic society. Any society which is materialistic is insane. But the modern world is intense insanity. This wearing this cloth shouldn't be just some... It shouldn't be identified with ethnic Indian clothing, but our message should be propagated so powerfully that people see this, say, oh, they're the Hare Krishnas. They're the ones who are offering an alternative to this money culture, which is just based on grinding people up from the beginning of their life, and just making people into just objects in a machine which is meant for producing more and more power and money for a few people. So many people would appreciate that if they knew it. So yeah, this dress and our culture, in one sense it's Indian, yes, but in a broader sense it transcends any national boundaries. So the standards are there, they are the standards given by Chaitanya Mahaprabhu to Rupa Goswami and Sanatan Goswami, who gave them in their books, which we have received in parampara through Srila Prabhupada, and we should introduce this Vedic culture, understanding very well what is Vedic culture. We're not just trying to bring in some Hindu religion or something like this, but Vedic knowledge means, ultimately Vedic knowledge is meant to transcend all material designations, sarvopadhi vinir muktam, to be free of all material designations. In other words, this dress should be seen as people who have a higher motive than this world, but at the same time offer a very practical way of living in this world, so that we can get out of this world. So really our movement has great potential, and we have to discover that and establish that. It's a great challenge to do so. It's easier just to have a temple and ring some bells and go out sometimes in the park and chant Hare Krishna. But actually it's supposed to be a movement for the re-spiritualization of human society. Just like we say to people, if we understand what the purpose of life is, it's going to change our whole life. If we understand that we're birth after birth, we're stuck in this material world, now is the opportunity to come out and achieve our real position in love of Krishna beyond birth and death, That should change our whole life. If we're still interested in power, position, money, politics, it means we missed. We may be going through the motions of being a devotee, but we missed the point. So similarly, as a movement, if we're going through the motions of having temples and having festivals and ringing bells, sometimes going out on Harinam, distributing some books here and there, but we don't have the vision of what we're supposed to be doing as a movement. It's supposed to be changing the world, showing a better way of life. It's better in every respect. Then these questions will arise, and then it may seem more realistic to go back to wearing jeans and t-shirts and playing ping pong and just mixing men and women and everything, because, well, what does it matter? It doesn't matter if we've lost sight of the goal of life. So bringing people in means we have to start somewhere. If we go completely down to their level, then the bridge preaching means we cross the bridge to their side. So we're supposed to bring them onto the bridge. If they want to come, we can't force them to come. And then bring them over the bridge. It should be visible what's on the other side of the bridge. But if we ourselves are not sure what's the difference between what's on both sides, and if we don't make a chasm between what we're doing and what everyone else is doing, then no question of bridge preaching, because there's nothing to cross, there's no gap to cross. So it's not that we're vegetarians who sing some Indian mantras. That's not our movement. It's a lot more than that. So yes, standards should be established. And that's also Varnashram. The brahmanas, they are supposed to follow at a very strict level. And others, for others there's more license. So brahmanas are supposed to set such a standard that everyone respects them. It's not by edict that you must respect brahmanas, but they automatically command respect because they are visibly detached from enjoying this material world. They are visibly acting for the benefit of others. They don't act in a duplicitous way. They act, what they say is simply for the benefit of others. All these things should be very clear, actually. So there will be always some allowance for newcomers. There has to be. But it'll be much easier for newcomers if they see what is the proper standard, and then they can aspire to come to that. And then it becomes clear where they're going. This seminar was just given in the morning by, seminar is a fancy name, talk, by Mahatattva Prabhu, this how one should be a liberal distributor of Krishna consciousness and a strict practitioner. Okay, from Bhakta Joey. What is your opinion on Krishna West? Okay, well, I just did that, more or less. Just came out anyway. Hare Krishna Maharaj. What pleases you the most? Top three. And what displeases you the most? Top three. Whew. I'm about to go and see my psychoanalyst and bring it out of my id. To tell you the truth, I never really did a self-psychoanalysis and tried to find out what pleases me the most. Krishna consciousness in general is very pleasing. Everything is pleasing about Krishna consciousness. We become very pleased. Become very pleased to see people practicing Krishna consciousness. I feel very pleased to have the opportunity to practice Krishna consciousness myself. Happy to see devotees making advancement, doing something significant in Srila Prabhupada's service. These things are all very pleasing. What displeases me is that which would displease most other people also. Hypocrisy, deception, cheating. These things are very displeasing, aren't they, to anyone? Displeased when Srila Prabhupada and what he gave is misrepresented. So, I don't know, I have to think about that more. When Srila Prabhupada was asked about that, what pleases you the most? At least twice devotees asked him that. And I think they were trying to line Srila Prabhupada up for saying book distribution. But Prabhupada was more smart that he could be lined up. So one time Srila Prabhupada said, when you chant Hare Krishna, and you're doing that. And when another time when Srila Prabhupada was asked, what would please you the most? And Srila Prabhupada said, if you become a pure devotee of Krishna. Okay, question from Bhakta Karim. Just looking at my watch here. We're supposed to leave at what time? 5:45? 5:30 we're supposed to leave, is it? 5:45, okay. Question from Bhakta Karim. And in order to achieve Krishna Prem, how should a devotee in modern times live both externally and internally? Cell phones, computers, socializing, Raganuga Bhakti, spiritual teachers. What expectation should a mature disciple have towards his spiritual teacher? Personalism, relationship. These questions are a bit vague. In order to achieve Krishna Prem, how should a devotee in modern times live both externally and internally? Externally, the general direction is anasaktasya visayanya taham upayunjataha nirbandha krishna sambandhe yuktam vairagya muchyate. One can utilize everything in the world in Krishna's service, knowing that everything in this world is related to Krishna, while at the same time not being attached to anything in this world. There is also the principle of simple living and high thinking, in which one lives as simply as possible. And although anything in the world can be used for Krishna's service, many of the things we don't need at all. For instance, it's said that one could... Facebook is a big venue for preaching because so many people are out there. But from what I've seen of Facebook, the level of interaction there is, it's not very suitable for preaching. It seems to be just slightly above the animal level of consciousness, maybe lower. It's just all people have some emotional feeling and they put it out on the Facebook, from what I've seen, from what little I've seen of it. So it could be used maybe for publicity, this program's going on, but I wouldn't attempt any serious preaching there because it seems people, they just flip through it anyway and they don't spend more than 3 or 4 seconds on any posting. Is it like that? It seems like that. It's so you could use it, but for serious you can use our internet, so commonly as we can use internet for preaching and this and that. But And theoretically, you can have your whole spiritual life on the internet. You can have Mangalarti, you can choose your lecture from all over the world. You can choose your Mangalarti, you can have a recorded Mangalarti. I remember at school in the English class, there was some book. I can't remember the name of it. It was supposed to be in the year 2000 and something, which when the book was written was quite well in the future, where everyone lived underground in some kind of hexagonal bubble, and their food came through a chute, and they just did everything with computers, and they never actually met anyone. It's something like that in the modern age. But it's actually very good to have real live sessions like this, where we deal with real people. It's what a person is. The concept of a person has been changed by Facebook. The word friend has been redefined by Facebook. And people don't know what is friendship. The more people we get to know, the less friends we have. Because we have limited capacity. Krishna has unlimited capacity to relate intimately with any number of people, but we don't. And so it becomes more and more artificial and impersonal. And big cities are places of big loneliness. So many people, but no one, no close friends. So it's also good preaching to go to the village with devotees, live simply, chant Hare Krishna, and don't have any electricity or any of these things. And people don't think it's possible, but it is possible. A few years ago, some devotees I'm connected with in India started some of these projects. And for years, people have been saying, no, no, no one will ever join. No one will ever agree to live like that. Although when I first went to live in India in the 1970s, most of the country didn't have electricity 24 hours a day. Actually, still there are some places don't have. I think everywhere in India now there's electrical connection, but not load shedding, as it's called, is quite common. That means the power just goes off. And you just wait for it to come back. Not that there's any break in the lines, it's just there's not enough electricity being generated to fulfill the demand. Voluntarily living without electricity. And devotees, some householder couples moved to these farms from prestigious, middle class, successful career to living without electricity. They made some concessions, which later they regretted. Concession means hand pump for water instead of pulling it up from a well. That's a concession. You can either pull it up, or there's another type which is less common. In Gujarat, it used to be quite common. You walk down, walk in. They have steps. You walk down, and you have to put the bucket in, then you have to walk up again. Or otherwise, the normal thing is you pull it up like this. Water supply that in Europe, modern European civilized, well, modern in Vedic terms means the last few thousand years. The Romans began that with their aqueducts. So man is always trying to make his situation better. But the Vedic culture is keep it simple. Keep it simple. That's what, live next to a river. That's considered best because there you have water. Gurukul should be on the bank of a river. That's considered the best. Of course, you have to choose which river because some rivers they flood regularly. But devotees are finding that they're very happy. They're very happy to live like that because in the city they're just under pressure, work, 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 work. But in living with devotees, they also have to do some work, but they're doing so it's physically much more healthy, and they're living with devotees. They have a full morning program, they have an evening program, they rise and rest with the sun, they rest early, and they automatically rise very early. They're fresh air. There are some things which are hazardous, like snakes, but then in the city there are trucks, and probably more people die in the cities from road accidents and accidents caused by electricity, home accidents, industrial accidents. So in the village there's also snake danger. There are things you can do about that also. So that's also one major way of preaching. This is our alternative. And we have our alternative education also. So we can live in the modern world and adjust to it, but at the same time we should know that this whole highly complex, unnecessarily complex civilization, as it's called, although really I don't find it very... In what way is it civilized? When you see young girls walking around in shorts, and that's just one thing which shows that's not civilized. It's uncivilized. Because, as Srila Prabhupada said, the whole purpose of varnashram culture is to overcome the sexual drive, the sexual attraction, which is pungsangstriya mithuni bhavametam tayoraho hridaya grantimahuhu. It's the binding knot in material life is the attraction between male and female. So the Vedic culture allows for interaction, but not by increasing the material disease of attraction between male and female, but regulating it in a civilized way, which means within marriage, and marriage is for procreation of children, and the children are to be trained in the same Vedic culture, the ultimate goal of which is Krishna consciousness. So, although it's called civilization, it's not really civilized. So, we can live in this world, and as long as we're part of this civilization, living within it, then we may use cell phones and this and that and the. But overall, the whole civilization is one big anartha. It's all unnecessary. It's also a major part of preaching to demonstrate that there is a better way of life. And even while living in this civilization, keep things as simple as possible. From what little I've seen of Facebook, I don't recommend getting into it. But some things like that. You can announce festivals, maybe post pictures of deities and this and that, but in general it's another dumbing down, making people less and less intelligent. Even their whole ideas about education, they have all these ideas about how to educate children, but the result of their new policies for education means that the average child in America going to school is, America in terms of education is way behind. It's maybe number 17 in the world or something like that, which not very impressive for a country that's supposed to be. One reason why America has so many intelligent people is they import them, like many of you who are here today. So, dumbing down, it makes people's Facebook and TV and pornography and sports, and it makes people stupid. So don't be victimized by that. How much can we use? And then the whole cell phones, computers, it's almost like a necessity in the modern age, although Apurva Prabhu hardly use them, and he seems to be living his life quite well, very well. I use it. I use a computer basically for writing books. It doesn't make sense in the modern age to write books not using a computer. I started writing books before the age of mass use of computers, and it was a lot more work. I started printing books before it all became computerized. So I started in the age of hand typesetting, which is a technology which goes back hundreds of years, where you pick out the type. There's typesetter. He picks out with the tweezers one type, inserts it. You get a lot of typos, what's called a typo. So the mistake, someone picks out the wrong thing. That came up recently in the Chaitanya Charitamrita. We have written Kopin, spelled K-O-P long I-N-A. And Sri Giridhari Prabhu, my disciple, who's just overseen the translation of Srila Prabhupada's Chaitanya Charitamrita into Tamil. So he said, is this the right spelling? Because everywhere else it's spelled K-A-U-P long I-N-A. So then I looked at the Bengali and the Gaudiya Math edition, and it's K-O. But I suspected this is a typo, because K-O and K-O-U, they look almost, O and A-U, they look almost the same in Bengali, in Hindi also. So I looked at other editions of Chaitanya Charitamrita published by other non-Gaudiya Math editions, and there it is, it's K-A-U. So it seems that someone who did the first Gaudiya Math edition typeset it wrongly, and that typo has been maintained over the generations. So anyway, how did I get onto that? So yeah, and then there's that, and then there came linotype, and then there was photo typesetting, and these all came within a short time of each other, and now it's all computerized. So it's much easier, and you can correct your mistake. It doesn't make any sense to either you type it out, or you write it by hand, and you get someone to type it, then you give it to the typesetter who looks at the typed manuscript, and each time you want to edit it, you have to do it manually. So it makes sense nowadays to do it with computers. You can do a lot of research by computer, keep in contact by email and this and that. We have this, we have books, we have Srila Prabhupada's books, and all the conversations, so it's a good resource, but at the same time, we should be careful not to be victimized by it. So we can use these things. Socializing in Krishna consciousness. But socializing doesn't just mean to blabber off and waste your time. Better to be busy in Krishna's service. Raganuga Bhakti. Yeah, ISKCON is meant for Raganuga Bhakti. It means that everything should be done with feeling and with full surrender, giving ourselves to Krishna. But we follow Vaidhi Bhakti under the guidance of Rupa Goswami and under the guidance of our acharyas, which are meant for regulating our life in such a way that we hear about Krishna, we chant about Krishna, we serve Krishna, so that naturally by coming in contact with Krishna in this way, our feelings for Krishna will arise. Premature Raganuga Bhakti is not recommended. Spiritual teachers, I don't know what I should say about that. It's quite vague. What expectation should a mature disciple have toward his spiritual master? Spiritual teacher, yeah. Actually, Srila Prabhupada used the word spiritual master. Now it's become spiritual teacher. It's a significant change of word, isn't it? Spiritual master, spiritual teacher. Srila Prabhupada could have translated guru as spiritual teacher, but he translated as spiritual master. Guru is supposed to be a teacher, but janme janme prabhu she, he's my master birth after birth. That's the understanding. Expectation should be that the spiritual teacher or spiritual master should teach, should be, you made this also, the conduit of the truth. He should present both by practice and by precept. That means he should present the truth. Practice and precept means achar and prachar. He should live as a representative of the truth, which is found in Shastra. And he should teach that. That's what's given in Shastra. And other things we may hear about this relationship, how he smiles at you, how he understands your heart, that may or may not be there, but that's the what we are guided in Shastra to see is that the one should approach a guru who is Shabde Parecha Nishnatam Brahmanyu Pashamashrayam, which means that he's immersed in the knowledge of the Vedas and has taken shelter of the Supreme Personality of Godhead by the parampara system. Just recently I read something, I can't remember where it's from, when a devotee asked Srila Prabhupada about their personal relationship with their guru, who at that time, the guru was Srila Prabhupada. He was the guru of the Hare Krishna movement. He insisted on the title Founder Acharya, which the very title Founder Acharya suggests that there are going to be other Acharyas also. Tell that to the Ritvik people. Otherwise there's no need for such a title. He could just be Acharya. Why Founder Acharya? He's the only Acharya. So Srila Prabhupada said, well, first of all, they should chant their 16 rounds and follow the four regulated principles. First of all, they should obey. Let them do that. And then afterward, we can maybe think about all these things. First, your duty is to obey. That's all. So what is your expectation? You don't have an expectation, in as much as first you have to follow. You have to see. Expectation means first you should see if the guru is Shabde Pareta Nishnatam Brahmanyu Pashamashrayam. And then you follow. And the expectation is that by following, if you do your part, he does his part, and then there will be the gradual progress on the path back to Godhead. How exactly the guru does that may be different. Different with different gurus, and even Srila Prabhupada was not exactly the same as Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. He was a different person. Yeah, he was dealing with different people. He dealt with everyone differently, but he had the same basic expectation of everyone, which is you have to chant minimum 16 rounds and follow the four regulated principles. And be serious in practicing Krishna consciousness. So that's there for everyone. And otherwise don't... we try to make some kind of mental trip. I want my guru should be like this or like that. Just it's based on obedience. Spiritual master means there's supposed to be obedience. So first there should be surrender and obedience, and not coming in first of all with my demand, my expectation. Hey, guru, what are you doing? You should be like this. Then you're not fit to be a disciple anyway. If you have so many expectations, simply you are prepared to follow and obey and submit. That is the position. It's a heavy demand. Guru means heavy, and disciple is also supposed to be heavy, supposed to be deep. Shishya is the word. Disciple means discipline. Shishya means, it means the same thing. One who is disciplined, one who is under control. So now nowadays we have this whole thing of the guru having to dance around the ego of the disciple and try and psychologically work them out. But actually, there's this whole idea that the guru and how he smiles at you and he understands your inner heart. And inner heart, yeah, it's easy to understand. Inner heart means it's full of lust, greed, material attachments, misconceptions. That's what the inner heart, that's what's in your inner heart. Inner heart means we're pure soul, but that's lost under so many clouds of conditioning. So that we think, what we think is myself is not myself at all. So we don't even understand who we are. We're so illusioned that we mistake the present conditioning the present state of our conditioning that we're in, which we've received through association with the modes of material nature, we mistake that to be myself. And we think that the guru is someone who has to interact with this imagined person, this imagined persona that I imagine to be myself. So at least if we can theoretically understand that what I think is myself is not, I don't even know who I am. Just submit. I'm just submit and be prepared to hear and serve and surrender and follow. That is the faith that is required to be a disciple. It's not in our Krishna conscious movement, we're not supposed to be in competition with all these new age, totally bogus people who are making spiritual life even more confused by appealing to people's false egos and pumping up their false egos. But a real guru is someone who they either pop the false ego or re-channel it and shape it and direct it toward Krishna. But if we think that the guru is someone who's supposed to nurture my false ego, then we don't belong here anyway. We should go off. And, you know, there's Sri Sri and Dalai Lama and all these kind of people. You can go and see them. They'll give you a nice massage for your ego. Another question. Do we have time? No. Okay, let's go. Over time.